We have gotten to the beginning of the destruction of the city of Sodom, and we left off, as I recall it, chapter 19, verse 15. Lot has warned his family that the city is about to be destroyed, and they don't take him seriously, which is unsurprising, after all. But since it is unsurprising, you have to assume that the Bible includes it to make a point. And I suppose the point is something about Lot's sons-in-law. That is, they're typical Sodom people. They don't take serious things seriously. So, the next day, as dawn broke, we're on chapter 15, the angels urge Lot on, saying, up. Verse 15. What did I say? Chapter? I'm sorry. Verse 15. Chapter 19, verse 15. Sorry about that. As dawn broke, the angels urged Lot on, saying, up, take your wife and your two remaining daughters, because the other two, of course, are married and they're not leaving, lest you be swept away because of the iniquity of the city. And then it says, Vayitmama. Still he delayed. And once again, we talked about this once before, but I'll now give you the full-blown explanation, I hope. Look above the word Vayitmama, and you see in that word there is what's called a shalshelet, right above the word, that little jagged line, okay? Shalshelet means chain in Hebrew. And the shalshelet is a triple trill up and down. So the way you would read that is Vayitmama. Okay? In other words, it simulates delay in the note itself. That is the first time that you find a shalshelet in the Torah. And I want to give you the two other occurrences. Turn to chapter 39 in Genesis, verse 8. When we get to this, I'm sure we'll do it again, because we will long since have forgotten. But chapter 39, verse 8. Okay. Yep. Verse 8. Okay, here is where Potiphar's wife is trying to seduce Joseph, and it says, we did mention it, Vayima'ein, and Joseph refused, but there's a shalshelet there too, like, he didn't just say, no, I'm out of here. It took him a little while to actually refuse, and the note shows that, right? There is hesitation in his refusal. And the last one, which is very interesting psychologically, is in Leviticus, and it's chapter 8, verse 23. There are only three of them in the Torah. 8:23. Okay. And here, I'll read you the explanation. This is where the Torah is relating Moses' preparations for the dedication of the tabernacle. Okay? The rabbis say that had Moses not argued with God about taking the responsibility to bring the Israelites out of Egypt, he might have been the high priest. But instead, it was given to Aaron. Moses had to practice every procedure required for the service of the tabernacle and teach them to Aaron. He was thrilled that his brother held such an important office, But when the passing of the full responsibility of the office was given to him, he hesitated. In other words, he has to practice this, and then he has to show Aaron how to do it, because Aaron's going to be the high priest, he's not. So it was hard for him to engage in these practices because he knew they wouldn't be his. So the Shalshelet here shows Moses' hesitation in learning things that he's not going to be able to do, that he's going to have to give Aaron to do. Right? He's handing over the family business, and he doesn't really want to do it. So all three times the Shalshelet is there, it's supposed to show us a divided soul, basically, a reluctance on the part of the person to do what it is they know they are supposed to do. Joseph knows he's supposed to say no. Moses knows he's supposed to hand over the thing. And also, Lot knows he's supposed to run away. And all of them do it, but they hesitate. Yeah.
Is this in the text that's in the Chumash, or is that Kohelet in the Torah as well?
No, I think it's only in the five books. I don't know how many Shalshelets are in the whole Tanakh, and I don't have it here, but I can take a look. The trope doesn't appear originally in any, if you open the Torah scroll, you won't see the trope.
Right.
It was developed by mainly the Masoretes in like the 8th, 9th century, based on older traditions, because they chanted the Torah from time immemorial, and there is now trope on every book of the Bible. If you open Kohelet, there's trope. If you open Ruth, never in the scroll, but always in the book. Any book of the Bible, if it's in Hebrew, will have the trope.
There have to be many examples of this kind of psychological dynamic.
Right.
In the Torah, yep. Abraham and his son. So is there, is there anything about that is specific to these three?
It's a great question. The question was, there have to be a lot of examples of divided souls in the Bible. The answer is no, not that I know of. It works here. He delayed, he refused. They're all on verbs. He delayed, he refused, he slaughtered. And the trope sometimes the trope is revealing, sometimes it's less revealing to me. But I'm not aware of anything that distinguishes these three unless, and in fact, they're not even for the three most important characters. You could say that Joseph and Moses are very important, but Lot? Why would you waste a Shalshelet on Lot? But they do. So, yeah.
They share in common. That's
I suppose if we thought about it long enough, we could probably come up with something. What's that?
It even applies
to lesser characters, right? How about this? All three of them lost their home. Lot lost his home, Moses loses his home, and Joseph loses his home. But I don't know. It would be an interesting study to try to figure out why those three get the Shalshelet and nobody else does.
Well, yeah. Actually, there's no difference between Lot and the other two guys. We're all Lot. The other two guys are very special.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Lot is every man, which is not encouraging. It's really not. You can see human beings as basically noble, and sometimes they do bad things, or as basically not so noble. Judaism takes refuge in the idea that everybody is split. You know, we have a good inclination and an evil inclination, and at any moment, either one of them could be actualized. But both are here with Lot. Both of them are. He delays presumably because he doesn't believe it or because he has too much that he loves in Sodom. It's very hard to believe that a city is going to be destroyed. So, and notice how the delay ends. They seize his hand. That is, God forces him out, which is an argument for those who think that Lot was saved because he was connected to Abraham. Why should God go really through so much trouble to save Lot? It's not like he's so, yeah.
I was going to say, this is so much like what happened in Germany. And you would think that that they would have learned, they may not have been as into the Torah.
Even, yeah.
But people are very certainly what was going to happen to Germany was the same thing almost.
Let me bring up the Germany parallel is an interesting one because I've just been talking about it with my UCLA class. The first thing to remember is that the Torah is full of examples of different kinds. So you have to pick the right example for your situation. You know, I don't know how many of them saw in Lot. Second, remember, it is so difficult to leave your home that it's in some ways amazing that so many Jews left their home. I mean, my great-grandparents came here before the First World War. They left Russia, as did in the 1880s. I mean, millions of Jews left. So many, many, many Jews left. It was, in fact, the most traditional Jews that didn't leave. Right, Arthur Hertzberg, in fact, says the reason Jewish scholarship in America is not so impressive, in his view, is because all the greatest scholars stayed back in Eastern Europe and were killed. Second, you know, it's very hard. The historical difference between after the Holocaust and before the Holocaust is very difficult to envision. It's like, Yehuda Bauer or someone who was talking to a class of Israeli high school kids about the Holocaust and what happened, and they said, well, why didn't we just send the Air Force? The idea that there was no Israel, there was no Air Force, there was no anything, I mean, it was just, we've got an Air Force, why didn't we just bomb John and understand? And the notion that a Holocaust could happen didn't exist in a pre-Holocaust world. The strategy for the Jews for thousands of years was, you play one person off the other, you balance between different powers, you appease the rulers, you show how helpful you are to the country, and even if there may be some persecution, you outlive it, and the Jewish community survives even though terrible things can happen. That there would be a systematic slaughter of Jews all through Europe, it was just inconceivable. And if somebody had said, as some people did, but the vast majority didn't, if somebody had said to their family, this guy wants to kill all Jews throughout Europe, they would have said, that's ridiculous. Why would someone want to kill all the Jews of Europe? Look at all we do and look at all we are and so on. It wouldn't have entered someone's mind. And I don't think Lot would have been a sufficiently powerful counterexample for them to believe it. And also because Germany wasn't Sodom. And part of the problem, throughout Jewish history, there have been a lot of Jews who have loved their country at various times. There was never a Jewish community that was as in love with its country as German Jews were with Germany. They loved Germany. They loved it. I mean, German Jewish literature was like the peak of Western and of Jewish literature in the time. All of Heine's poems were read by German school children, so much so that when the Nazis came in, they couldn't get rid of Heine's poetry from the German school system. They had to just leave off his name so nobody would know it was written by a Jew. So it was the notion that Germany particularly could turn on the Jews so much was really hard to believe. It was just hard to believe. I mean, it started with Moses Mendelssohn a couple hundred years before, the symbiosis. In fact, if you really want to get a sense of how powerful this connection was, and how painful was the severing of it, you can read Amos Elon's book called The Pity of It All. It's a very good read, and it will give you a really clear sense of what German Judaism meant and was about. It's a good book. There are a couple of other books on it, too. There's one by Howard Sacker called Dreamland, but I really recommend Elon's, The Pity of It All, rather. Amos Elon, E-L-O-N, is his last name, and it's called The Pity of It All. So the men seized his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters in the Lord's mercy on him and brought him out and left him outside the city. So they had to physically bear him outside because he just wasn't ready to leave. When they had brought him outside, one said, flee for your life. Do not look behind you nor stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the hills lest you be swept away. Now, first of all, why can't he look back? What's the prohibition against looking back? Okay, first, psychologically, you can think in terms of regret. What else?
You might see God, you're not supposed to.
All right, it could also be that, you know, God is going to descend and destroy the city and you're not allowed to see God. There could be a sort of theological / magical prohibition. I don't know what's going on in there. Sorry. I'm trying my best. I can't actually speak much louder than this. If you want to move closer, you can, but I can't really, I can't yell the whole class. It's too hard. What else? Yes. That he gets swept in, like almost like a hurricane or a... Right, that's what it was like. Yeah. Right. You can't turn around and look forward at the same time. When disaster happens, you can't do both simultaneously. You just have to move everybody out. It's just like those of you who know baseball, you're never supposed to, when you're running for a ball, you're never supposed, when you run around the bases, you're not supposed to look back. And when you're running for a fly ball, you're not supposed to look back unless you're Willie Mays. He was famous for that. What?
Don't look back, they may be catching you.
Right, that's also true. Satchel Paige used to say that. Yeah. Right, so there, yeah, although at this moment, you can understand why Lot would want to look back. Right, his family is there, and also something incredible is happening, you know? It's like, I mean, just think of when a crash happens on the side of the road. Everybody stops, everybody looks. There's something magnetizing about human destruction. And the same thing happens on television. It's why people watch local news, which is a parade of destruction, right? There's a fire here and a crash there. So it is very powerful. But Lot said to them, "Oh no, my Lord, you've been so gracious to your servant. You've already shown me so much kindness in order to save my life. But I can't flee to the hills lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Look, that town there is near enough to flee. It's such a little place. Let me flee there. It's such a little place." He says that twice, notice. "And let my life be saved." Now, the little place that he wants to go to is called Soar, and it was slated for destruction. But Lot has, in fact, in 1917, where he says, "Don't look behind you or stop anywhere on the plain." According to Rashi, exactly the same division we had. According to Rashi, it's Lot's worried about his family, property, and according to Ramban, he's worried about his family. So it depends how cynical you are about Lot's character. But they save the city of Tsoar for him. He replied, "Very well, I'll grant you this favor too, and I will not annihilate the town of which you have spoken. Hurry, flee, for I can't do anything till you arrive there." Hence, the town came to be called Tsoar. So here is... Remember, there were originally five cities that were supposed to be destroyed. I don't remember which verse they're listed in, but there were five cities altogether. Lot ends up saving one of them. I'll tell you where. No, I won't, and I won't bother looking for it. But Lot ends up saving one of them, remarkably enough, by pleading with the angel, despite the fact that Abraham can't save them by pleading. Lot does it out of self-interest, and Abraham can't do it out of nobility. Yeah.
Why is he saved at all?
Well, I don't know. You tell me, why is Lot saved? He's either saved because he's not so bad, and he doesn't deserve to be killed. I mean, you know, it's a lot to kill somebody. So either that, or he's saved because he's related to Abraham, and God's doing Abraham a favor, basically. So one of those two possibilities, and which possibility depends on your evaluation of Lot's character here. and your evaluation of the earlier story with the angels and the blindness and his daughters. But it is remarkable that he manages to save Tzoar because he wants to move there. Abraham doesn't have that success. Why that is so, I mean, you could say, I don't know. Why that is so? It's a good question. I'm not sure that I know the answer to it, except that realistically it's true, that sometimes noble efforts don't succeed where very self-interested comments or efforts do succeed. And that is, you know, that's, it's the same thing as if you're teaching a class or with your children. Ah. So, if you're teaching a class or you're with your children, it is often the case that the one who is most annoying gets the most. It's not fair. Someone else will come in and say, may I have a cookie, mother, please? And you say, no, it's right before dinner. And they'll say, okay, thank you, mother. And the other one will come in and say, I have to have one. Give me one, please give me one. I'm so hungry, you got to give me one. Finally, you give him the cookie just to shut him up, right? And Lot is the second one, yes. That is. Right. Yep. This is a beautiful, a beautifully optimistic interpretation of Lot's intentions. It doesn't make it wrong. It doesn't make it wrong. It just makes it, although what happens afterwards throws a crimp in it. But the idea is that he's going to Tzoar because he can show them how to repent. Because unlike Abraham, he's lived a life of sin, and therefore, and you know, it says in the Talmud that a place where a repentant sinner stands, even the high priest can't stand, or somebody who has never sinned can't stand, because you raise higher, because it's harder to recover from a sin than it is to never sin. In the same way that, here's another analogy, staying with the cookie analogy, it is much harder to take one bite of a piece of cake than not to eat any of it, right? It's much harder to sin and then stop, and so if you see Lot, and also it's much more, you're much more likely to be able to inspire other sinners than if you're perfect, right? So, yes, that is possible. That certainly is possible. Where did God intend to take him? It doesn't say. Somewhere. Oh, it's on somewhere on the hills beyond all the cities, but I don't know where exactly that was. For whom? Yes. Yes. He was afraid to go there. Well, the other thing is he shows a ridiculous lack of trust. When they save him and they say, go there, and he says, I don't want to go there because I might die. Let me go there. I mean, he has no idea of what the disaster is going to be, and they're saving him. And why does he? Lot feels to me like an operator. He's always got an angle. You know, he's even as he's running away and leaving his two kids behind, he's thinking, you know, Tzoar looks like a nice piece of property. If I can save Tzoar, when this is over, I'm going to come out of this really well, you know? They'll destroy those cities. All of a sudden, I'll have beachfront property in Tzoar, you know? That's how it feels, yeah.
What I'm confused about his intention is that at the end of this chapter, he does not end up living in Tzoar. He ends up living in a cave.
I know. Yes. I don't know either. It is a good question. I think it might be that Tzoar was not a desirable place to live afterwards. Although I don't remember, and I don't even know if it says where Lot actually ends up, where he lives at the end. But only for as long as he has intercourse with his kids. Where does he go after that? But I'm saying, where does he live? You know, he settles in the hill country. For he was afraid to dwell in Tzoar. Yeah, he lives in a cave for a while. I don't know where he lives permanently. So he ends up where they told him, They said, go to the hills. He says, I can't go there. I've got to go to Zoar. Then the destruction comes, and he doesn't want to live in Zoar. So,
little.
Yeah.
So he shortchanged himself.
Yes. He clearly did. I don't know. It's very interesting. This requires more research. I'll have to look more into the what the commentators say about the fact that Lot says, I can't go to the hill country because it'll destroy me. I want to go to Zoar. And then after the destruction, he doesn't live in Zoar. He lives in the hill country. I don't know. There's something there, but I can't put my finger on it. So does anybody have a commentary that says anything about that? Stone or Eitz Chaim or anything? No? Okay. All right. Well, if you find something, let me know, and I'll take a look, too, for next week. Yeah.
I don't recall who of Abraham's relatives are still around at this point, but could perhaps God be saving Lot just to have a standby relative for Abraham since he's old and he's going to have a kid? Maybe there needs to be another
family.
Man somewhere alive to step in. He's the best source, but if he's a relative.
Maybe he's just trying to preserve family. Like, you go to the lawyer and you say, well, look, I don't really like my in-laws, but, if something happens to us, I guess you can send the kids to them, because there's really nobody else. And it's better to have them with family, even though it's family, that I'm not close to, than it is to send them to somebody, who's not related. And that's how you get all these Victorian novels about people being raised by step-parents who don't really like them, and, it's terrible, and so on. Anyway. But, yeah, that could be. It could be. Yeah.
Rashi says that Zoar was a newer city, and they had sinned less.
They had less time to sin. I like that. Anyway, so maybe we shouldn't be advertising our centennial. Yes. Well, it is and it isn't. What Marcia said is that this is kind of a loophole around the "I won't destroy you again" promise. What God promises is not to destroy the world. God does not promise not to destroy individual communities or cities or whatever. And in fact, throughout history and war and so on, that's what has clearly happened. So, I don't know. It's not a loophole around the whole clause, but it clearly doesn't say that I won't ever destroy communities or lands or whatever.
Doesn't the story require that there be a survivor to tell others what happened?
The story seems to require that there be a survivor to tell others what happened, but as you'll see, Abraham sees the destruction, and we do have the omniscient narrator. That's true in the story of Job, when everybody gets killed except one servant who has to run back to Job and tell him that everything terrible happened. But I don't know if it's as true here. Yeah.
So initially the discussion between Abraham and God was that there should be at least 10 people in order to save
right.
the city. But so now God saves essentially just
three. Well, four. He was going to save his wife, but right.
So now, why could he be so just in this case, but then in most other cases, kind of, we said that community justice wins out and the individual gets sacrificed?
Well, the question of why community justice gets played out. Most famously in the book of Joshua, when one person takes Achan, takes stuff that he's not supposed to take, spoils of war, and as a result, the people, they lose a battle. And obviously many people get killed in that battle who, would have survived had he not done that. Why in this case that doesn't happen is another argument for the idea that God is saving Lot specifically because Lot is connected to Abraham. So it's not just that God is practicing individual justice here and doesn't elsewhere, but maybe it's really God is watching out for Abraham in every way he can, because what's
we are all connected to Abraham.
Yes, that's true, but we're not all nephews. It's just the best that I can come up with. The question almost always of imbalance in the way people are treated opens up to the general evil question, for which there isn't, there are answers, but there isn't a sufficient answer that we can treat it in one case and just move on. You can ask yourself, the same question about Noah and his, I mean, Noah in the time of the ark, that also clearly is collective justice. Were there no children who might grow up to be good, who could have, Noah could have adopted and brought in the ark with him, or it's an endless issue. The same with Egypt and the death of all the firstborn. Were all the firstborn bad? Although I heard a great, you want to hear an ingenious theory about the death of the firstborn in Egypt? This is a really good one. I reviewed actually for the Jerusalem Post about a year or two ago, a book by a British anthropologist who tries to give the best that I've ever read, tries to give common sense explanations for all the events of the Exodus, the splitting of the sea, all the plagues, and so on. And the most difficult one is the death of the firstborn, right? How could that possibly be any way scientifically or naturally explained? And this is his explanation, which is really very good. He says, if there was tainted grain in Egypt, and there was some kind of famine, in almost every household, the one child who would be fed would be the firstborn boy. So it is really possible that not only, he says it couldn't be that only the firstborn, but that predominantly the firstborn would die if there was tainted grain and there was a famine, because the one child that you're going to feed to save is the firstborn boy, because he's the one who's going to grow up to inherit the, which is a pretty ingenious attempt to, you got to give him credit for ingenuity to rescue that plague. Anyway, I don't remember how I got there, but Lot gets saved. Yes?
Specifically, is Lot afraid of, when it says the evil,
I'm assuming that he's referring, that's a sort of generic term for whatever is about to happen in Sodom, because he hasn't seen it yet. Something terrible is going to happen. Well, but he's just told, we got to get out of here because this place is going to be destroyed. So it's not just in the mountain. He wants to go as far as possible. So maybe, and it does, I think he probably feels safer in a city than he does exposed on the mountain. That's my sense of it. I don't know. I mean, it's a very, you know, it's fairly traumatic. And don't forget what Lot just went through. I mean, he just saw these two people blind all the people of the city who were about to come in and kill him. So he's not in such a good state anyway. As the sun rose upon the earth and Lot entered Zoar, the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah sulfurous fire from the Lord out of the heaven. Now there is a redundancy there, but when it says the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfurous fire from the Lord out of heaven, okay, it's showing two things. First of all, that it doesn't come from the earth, that it came from the sky. This is verse 23 and 24. And second, that it came from God. Right, so the repetition of the Lord there, I think, is to show us two things. The Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, sulfurous fire from the Lord out of heaven. Okay, it's a supernaturalish sort of fire. It's not a normal fire. He annihilated those cities and the entire plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and the vegetation of the ground. Lot's wife looked back and she thereupon turned into a pillar of salt. Why? Why a pillar of salt? First of all, when you destroy a city, what do? If you don't want anything to regrow there,
you burn it.
You sow it with salt. Sow it with salt. Right after it's burnt, you sow it with salt, and salt prevents things from regrowing. Okay? That's why nothing grows in the Dead Sea, because you can't grow something in salt. Second, there were a lot of salt deposits around the area of the Dead Sea. So it's not uncommon that this tradition would grow up around the Dead Sea, because there are mounds of salt. I don't know how far back the tradition goes of calling them Lot's wife, but it could be a very ancient one. Any other thoughts about why in particular a pillar of salt?
Tears.
Tears is the other. Was that what you were going to say?
No.
Right. Tears is another one. Salt clearly represents tears and sadness, as it represents, by the way, one other thing. Do you remember what salt was in the ancient world? What did people use salt for?
Preservation.
To preserve things also, right. preservation. So if you want to really do a sermon on the idea that this memory should never be forgotten, that it should be preserved, yeah. There's more to this. Well, this David Steinberg, who used to do, David Steinberg, and if I could find it, I should bring it in. He used to do all sorts of very funny biblical routines. Like he does one about the burning bush where Moses comes up to the burning bush and God says, take your shoes from off your feet for the place where you stand is holy. And Moses takes his shoes off and burns his feet. And God, and God says, aha, third one today. You know, I mean, it's like that kind of thing, right? Very irreverent, but very funny. So he has one about this where Lot and his wife are leaving Sodom, and she goes, Lot, it was nice there. Why do we have to go? We had such a good time. It was so much fun. And this goes on. And finally, Lot says to her, dear, God told me to tell you to look back. So they're saying, you know. So when you said there was a missing dialogue, you know, that's the missing dialogue. David Steinberg has supplied us with the missing dialogue. But David Steinberg, he was a comedian for many years, and then he became a director. He directed a lot of Seinfeld episodes and other comedic episodes. I had the record as a kid. I mean, I don't know if it still exists on CD or whatever, but it's David Steinberg, and he did, if I can find it, as I brought in the Bill Cosby on Noah, I'll see if I can find the David Steinberg. It was very funny, and he did a series of them. I mean, you know, he grew up, obviously, this was his material. He grew up as a Jewish boy and learned these stories, and there is definitely comedic potential. So, anyway. Yes. Right.
And, you know, I had an acquaintance say to me that he sort of felt like the human race was a failed experiment.
Well,
I don't know if I would go that far, but when it comes to depravity,
right.
Yeah,
as far as the Bible is concerned, it's clear that the human race, if not a failed experiment, is at least a continually failing experiment, which is, by the way, the impression that I think you also get if you open the newspaper in the morning. I mean, it's just rare that there isn't something very depressing. Yes?
Don't you think that Lot's wife looked back, not just because she wanted to live in a city of sin, but because she had two daughters who were living there, and she, you know, and her family was there. I mean,
and also, and it's just, how do you not look back? When you hear a city being destroyed by fire from heaven behind you, how do you not look back? I mean, it takes iron self-discipline to not look back.
And to go on, then Abraham does look.
Right.
And, you know,
he looks at the after the destruction. After the destruction. Right. But he doesn't look, presumably he doesn't look during. It's like an eclipse. It's almost like an eclipse.
Yeah.
You know, you can't stare straight at the sun.
Mm-hmm. That looking back is being right in the midst of that kind of destruction, that if you really see it and feel it badly, you can be caught in it and preserved. And that this is such an incredible metaphor for the process that actually happens when people see something that's so overwhelming and rips out their entire reality. And by looking back, she's looking into that destruction itself, and people who are caught in whatever a destruction is, has this sense of both falling apart and disintegrating and being preserved in that moment. It's so exquisite in the way it really describes
captures
what happens
that.
When you kind of lose your mind into
which is
serious trauma or loss.
Which is clearly what's going on. I mean, you have to imagine the magnitude of the disaster here, you know, which is to lose everything you ever knew, completely destroyed. All the people you ever met, you ever met, your entire world completely destroyed. And in that sense, too, it has Holocaust analogies. I mean, if you're a survivor of the Holocaust and you grow up, as happens to us, you know how you frequently, you'll think of somebody you knew in grade school and you say, gee, I wonder whatever happened to so-and-so. Now imagine that you grew up in Germany or in Poland at the time of the Holocaust. When you think, oh gee, I wonder what ever happened to so-and-so. Chances are so-and-so was killed as a child. I mean, it's just unimaginable what the, anyway. All right, next morning, and this is I think this is an amazing scene. A really amazing scene. And you can just imagine what must be going on inside of him. Abraham hurried to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And looking down towards Sodom and Gomorrah and all the land of the plain, he saw the smoke of the land rising like the smoke of a kiln. Two things. First of all, when it says, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker El Hamakom, it literally means Abraham arose in the morning to the place. Arose to the place. Now, Hamakom is also a name for what in Hebrew? God. So, the idea here is that Abraham came not just to the place, but to the place of God. And then he looks at, now, I mean, you have to think about what he felt, but he looks at his, failure, right? Because now the smoke is rising up, and he knows that everything he prayed for and everyone he hoped to save, including, by the way, Lot, as far as we know. I don't think Abraham knows yet that Lot was saved. I don't see how he would know. It doesn't say that God told him. And everything is gone. And this smoke rising is an incredibly powerful image. I mean, you can just imagine the devastation and the wisps of smoke coming up, and that's all that remains from all these cities that were destroyed. Thus it was that when God destroyed the cities of the plain and the annihilated cities where Lot dwelt, God was mindful of Abraham and removed Lot from the midst of the upheaval. Okay? So, now, was mindful of Abraham in which way? Was mindful of Abraham's argument that you shouldn't let innocent people die, or was mindful of Abraham that he was Lot's cousin and so he took Lot out because, you know, he wanted to help him. I don't know, but either way, it's a very powerful scene, and the idea behind it that Abraham fails to move God to save people is going to be replayed again and again and again with Moshe, who is always going to be trying to save Israel from God's wrath and God's destruction, and the prophets who play both sides of the street. That is, they preach God to the people and they defend the people to God. But it starts here with Abraham because this is the first attempt that we have the first attempt that someone makes to save somebody not immediately connected to them, right? Noah saves his family, makes no attempt to save the world. But here Abraham actually makes an attempt to save people who have no connection to him, and he fails, so.
It's shuddering to think that the word kiln could be oven.
Yes, yep. Well, it also recalls, by the way, what's that? Yeah, exactly. I was going to say the midrash about Abraham. Remember that he was in an oven or kastim, that Abraham was rescued from an oven where he was supposed to be killed by the king. Yes.
Does this have any connection to the fact that with the burning of the pieces?
Maybe. I guess fire is such a. I mean, all the fire metaphors might be connected to each other, but it's also such a powerful metaphor, right, with the burning of the pieces. It's such a powerful metaphor that it's hard to know if this is supposed to be directly connected to the Brit Ben Habatarim, the covenant between the pieces. But there is something, there's nothing redemptive in this sacrifice. Yeah.
I was just going to ask if you think there's
is shaped,
given solidity.
It could be. I mean, you make something in a kiln, right? Not just, and it gets tested by fire, and if it survives, then it's solid. I don't know. A kiln is an oven where you put clay to bake it. Okay, that's a kiln, K-I-L-N. So, I don't know. I don't know.
Smoke rising from the
yes.
oven is such a picture of gas chambers.
There. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Anything else? Because I want to. I don't know if we should start. Maybe we should save the incest for next time. So that you can. Right. That way we could advertise it and tell people, you know, and in our next class.
Coming attractions.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
The fact that he needs Zoa to live, to go to the mountain.
Right.
I think that's connected to what we're
reading. Yeah, well, that's why what we were asking before about why he does leave. And I said that I needed to find out why he leaves the hill and goes to where he leaves Zohar and goes to the hill.
Because
yeah. Right.
And then the worst thing happens to him away from
Zohar. Not the worst thing. The worst thing is the destruction. That's what he seems to be afraid of. But something bad. Yeah. Supposed to be near the Dead Sea.
Is it?
Yeah, that's why the legend grows up. Yeah. That's true. It's a good point. Lot doesn't seem to be overly concerned about Abraham. Abraham's concerned about Lot, but you don't say Lot. Right. It's true. You don't hear him saying, "Got to get a telegram to Abraham." Right. Which you couldn't do anymore anyway, because there are no more telegrams.
If you view the destruction as an earthquake, even though it came from heaven,
yeah.
Then he could have left Zohar thinking, well, if it happened to Sodom, it could happen to Zohar. It's the same area, it's close by. We could have another destruction, so perhaps that's why he left.
It might be. It might be that he's afraid of another one. Yeah, or there was an aftershock. That's good. That makes sense. That does make sense. Remember that Lot's daughters are about to have sex with him because they assume there are no people left. So maybe Zohar is destroyed in the end, and that's why Lot both leaves it and why they think there's nobody left. I don't know. It's a very, you know, one of the things that this illustrates is that even the minor characters in the Bible, and Lot is, after all, a minor character, there's a very rich, there are mysteries and rich inner life to think about here. Because part of appreciating what happened to Lot is imagining yourself having gone through what he went through. I mean, remember that he leaves with Abraham. You have to look at the arc of his life. He leaves with Abraham. He goes to a place he doesn't know anything about. Abraham divides up. I mean, he doesn't want to be poor for having left with Abraham. So Abraham doesn't care, so he takes the lion's share of the land, or the best part of the land, and then he discovers that he's in the midst, or chooses to be in the midst, of a terrible place. He almost gets killed. He runs away. He escapes. The entire city gets destroyed. And now he's left, you know, really bereft of everything, including his wife, by the way, which, for all our laughter, you know, maybe they had a good marriage. Just because they lived in a bad place doesn't mean that they had four children together. And now she all of a sudden, without warning, without anything, she gets destroyed too. So it's not, you know, Lot didn't have an easy time of it. And he ends up living in a cave with his two grown-up single daughters for whom he doesn't have a match. And it feels like the whole world's been destroyed. Not an enviable fate, right? Not an enviable fate. And you could even imagine how at a certain point he must have not been happy with Abraham, that Abraham was responsible for saving him. You know, you could almost think, better that I should have been and I wouldn't face all this.
Well, yeah. If you look at these as the tribe of people that we've descended from and the families, right, and the interactions, it's so beautiful because it shows that our people had the mixtures of the Abrahams and the Lots and the thises and the thats.
Oh, yeah.
We really work in the families, and you look at that, we do have.
We have our horse thieves as well as our rabbis.
It isn't only the.
Yeah.
Exactly. We have the horse thieves, and you go go to Israel and you find that they have them all, and they're not just the Arabs there that are creating all the problems, etc. So the thing that this is so beautiful is that it's right in the beginning, and there's an old families have that wide range of character.
There's an old Yiddish proverb that says Jews are just like human beings, only more so. Right? So it's the same, yeah.
If God wanted Lot's lineage to continue on and, you know, eventually lead to King David, the Moab tribe, why? I mean, incest is so horrible.
Okay. And so perfect question to end on. Because next time we're going to talk about exactly about incest, about Lot, about the line of King David, which doesn't only come from incest, also comes from adultery. And so we'll cover the last eight verses next time, and maybe we'll get a chance to start on the second episode of Abraham passing his wife off as his sister, because once was not enough. All right, so next there.